Well, I wanted to do two things today. I wanted to talk about, I think, the importance of passing along our family stories and legacies to the next generation and the generation that follows. And, you know, we talk about that sometimes, and it doesn't happen, you know. And young people, when they get a little bit older and they say, I wonder a little bit about great-grandpa, great-grandma, what did they do? And so the idea to pass these stories along is something that occurred to me as several years ago, and I'll give you some examples of how that happened. I'm a storyteller. I've always been a storyteller. It's what I do. I tell stories. And I've been in broadcasting for over 50 years, 52 years, and I've been successful because of my ability to tell stories. Stories are like parables in the Bible. You know, when they tell a parable in the Bible, you remember it because of the story, and then there's a moral to the story, and that's how we remember parables. Well, I teach and train the same way, by telling stories. And I come from a long line of storytellers. My grandmother was a great storyteller and poet. And she had all these little poems memorized. And my Aunt Mary, which was her my dad's oldest sister, she was a storyteller. As a matter of fact, when she found out that I had an interest, she collected and saved all of the materials when my grandfather and grandmother immigrated to the United States from Italy, what port they left from, what ship they were on, when they had landed at Ellis Island, how they got to Youngstown, Ohio, which is where I was born and raised. And all of that information my aunt was able to pass along to me, and it created a narrative, right? It created a story of great-grandparents. Three out of my four grandparents I never met because they had passed away before I was born. And so this idea of telling stories has been something that I've always done. Over the years, people have said to me, you know, Tony, you need to write some of these stories down because they're such great stories. You need to write them down so that you can share them. And I was always reluctant to do so because my freshman year of college, I did my first paper and I turned it in and it came back an F. And the professor said, you will never write above a sixth grade level. And boy, that just flattened. That was the end of my writing career there. Of course, I used the same book report, the coach that nobody liked, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, senior year, and in my freshman year of college. And the grade got a little bit better, started out like as a D plus in 8th grade, and I got it up to a solid C minus there by the time I was in college. And so several years ago, with all of the people encouraged me to write down some stories, I began to sit down and write these little short parables, little short stories. They're about 700 words. You can read them in 5 minutes. The book is, there's 73 of them in the book. Somebody, a reviewer just did a big review online this week and said, it's a great bathroom book. And it said that as a compliment, you know, because you can read a story in about 5 minutes. And so I wrote an article in 2012 called When My Children Have Left the Faith. And it was picked up by a Christian magazine, and it is one of the most reproduced articles in church bulletins in the United States. And there are a lot of people our age who have adult children who have kind of strayed away from the faith. And not only have they strayed away, they're not bringing our grandchildren, and in some instances our great-grandchildren, up in the faith. And that bothers me from the standpoint that the Barna Research Company just released about a month ago, 51% of people under the age of 30 in the United States, when asked their religious affiliation, say none. None. In 1950, 80% of Christians went to church every Sunday. That is now under 20%. You know, I go to Mass every day and they call me Sonny. And I'm almost 70. And that concerns me. That's why when I hear babies crying in church, I love it. When a baby cries in church, it's like angels singing to me. And the reason is, it means that our faith has a future when we have young people. And so in my own instance, I want my grandsons to know who their grandfather and grandmother were. I want them to know who great-grandma and great-grandpa were. And I want them to know that we were Christians and strong Catholics, and our faith was a very important part of our lives. I want them to have that. Well, how am I going to do that? The only way I could do it is write it down. And so that's how I started. Since 2012, I've written 264 short stories. 73 are in this book. I've got a book coming out in August called A Storyteller's Guide to Joyful Service. It's about serving others, and it's currently being edited. I'll get it back from Michelle, and she'll say, gosh, this thing's at the sixth grade level. As a matter of fact, when I did some writing initially in 2012, I have a friend who's a former college English professor, and I gave her about a half a dozen of my stories, and I said, would you read these? And she said, sure, and she read them. I said, what'd you think? She said, they're fantastic. I said, no, that's not the important part. What level do you think I write at? And she goes, nah, I'd put you at about seventh grade. So I figure 40-some years since college, I'm up a grade, and that was good enough for me. And so I've written these stories. And so I think it's real important to all of us. Stan and I have talked about the Falkland Islands and World War II and George Patton. I'm fascinated by that information. And the only way that information gets passed along is, generally speaking, word of mouth. But it's even better when you can write it down. And that's what I've done. So what I thought I would do today is I'd share with you some of my stories. And the idea is, in the book, each story that I write has a piece of scripture attached to it. And I try to tie my stories into a scriptural reference. And then to learn from that scripture and from the story, I asked a few questions at the end of each story. And the hope is that they will trigger things in your own life. And perhaps by triggering stories in your own life, it might cause you to want to pass those along. I was born in an all-Italian family. Now, when you hear Italian, you think Catholic. First thing you think is Catholic. My dad was Italian Methodist. Who ever heard of that, right? And there was this tiny little Italian Methodist church, and that's where he went. That's where his parents went. That's where his sisters and brothers went. They were Italian Methodists. And what I learned from my dad was faithfulness. My dad would, when he got married to my mom back in the 40s, that was called a mixed marriage, right? Oh, there you have a mixed marriage.
Huh? Mom was Catholic.
My mom was a devout Catholic. And so what happened was my dad agreed that the kids would be raised Catholic. And he took that very, very seriously. And so every morning he would bring my mom and my sister and I to Mass. Then he would drive across town to St. Dominic's and pick up the two Dominican sisters who would teach our CCD, our Sunday school class. Then he would come back to church, and after church, the Dominican sisters would teach our Sunday school class. He would sit in the car and wait, read the Sunday newspaper. This is back when there was a thing called a newspaper. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
Back in the old days? He would read the newspaper. When our Sunday school was over, he would bring the Dominican sisters back to St. Dominic's, bring my sister and I home, and then he would go to the Methodist church to his church service. And he did that every single Sunday during the school year for 18 years. That's called faithfulness. So what I learned, and I learned a lot more, but I learned that faithfulness. A couple of my most prized possessions are the Bible he carried during World War II, a small little Bible that his church had given him for the handyman work that he had done, and two Methodist hymnals that I have in my Bible and hymnal collection. One is his, and one was my grandfathers who I never met. So see, we can learn from the people around us. First chapter in my book is God's grace through family. We get God's grace through our family. Huh? Mom and dad. My mom, as I said, was a devout Catholic. She was in charge of everything at the church. The linens were cleaned and pressed. The candles were polished. The candles, sticks were the bronze. Everything was perfect. And she took that very, very seriously. And we were in a little tiny Catholic church, doesn't exist anymore. And I was an altar boy till I was 22 years old because I was the only kid. So I was kind of stuck. But I learned my faith from my mom. And I wrote a piece called Thank You, Mom, for Making Me Go, because she would make me go. I would want to go to play with my buddies on Saturday, but I had to go to confession first. You go to confession, you can play with your buddy. And I had a little black friend, his name was Pork Chops. And Pork Chops would come over to the house and want to go out and play, and say, well, you have to go to confession first. And I had a choice of two churches. There was my church, which was about two blocks this way, and there was the Puerto Rican church, St. Rosa Lima, which was about two blocks that way, and the priest didn't speak English. So, man, you can go to confession and drop a load on him. I stole some popsicles from the grocery store, you know, whatever it was. And he'd give you tres sandamarias, and you'd be on your way, and I could go out and play. And so that I learned that from my mom. The other thing I learned as I got older is that we're all going to face difficulties in our lives. We're all going to have those moments. And 13 years ago, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. And, you know, the day I got that diagnosis from the doctor, I came home, and life went from this soft filter to crystal clear. Everything that was important, and those things that were not important were no longer important to me. And that crystal clear vision that I got helped me. That day I went on my email, and there was an email that I got unsolicited, and it was the seven great prayers. And the first prayer was, God, thank you for dot, dot, dot. And I said, God, thank you for an early diagnosis. God, thank you for a doctor who's there for me. Thank you for the fantastic nursing staff at the hospital. Thank you for a wife who will be with me by my side. And I began saying thank you. And 90 minutes later, I was still saying thank you. And when I finished, I never thought about my cancer again. God, you got this. And he did. 13 years cancer-free. One of the things that happened a year after that is I got a diagnosis of hepatitis C. We don't know if it was being blood brothers with Tonto and the Lone Ranger as a kid, or if I got nicked at the barber shop, or a blood transfusion when I was 5. You don't know. A lot of our generation have hep C and don't even know it. You read a lot about it, hear a lot about it. Or was it a product of bad doctoring and nursing that took place where, you know, the doctor do a house call and give all 6 kids a shot with the same needle? So we didn't. But I had it. And I went to the top hepatitis specialist in America. He's at the University Hospital. Pierre Golem is his name. Written tons of articles. And he did some what they call gene testing, genotype. And I have the genotype that drugs had the least effect on. They had about a 20%, 25% chance of a cure, a year of chemotherapy, interferon, all this, lose your hair, the whole thing, and it was probably 75% chance it wasn't going to work. I said, what do you recommend I do? He said, I recommend you wait. And so we did watchful waiting, and you probably have seen the ads on TV for Harvoni. Harvoni came out in 2014, and I was the perfect candidate for it, and it was the perfect drug for my gene type. And so, through my insurance company, I applied to get Harvoni, and I was turned down. And I applied a second time, and I was turned down. And then the nurses at his office really worked with me. We had to prove I wasn't a drug addict. We had to do all sorts of things. We applied the third time, and I was turned down. And right before Christmas in 2014, we applied one more time with all the information we had, knowing that it would be turned down again. And on January 2nd, the day after New Year's, when the mail came, there was a note from the insurance company that I was approved for Harvoni.
Yes.
It's $93,000 for Harvoni. You take a pill a day for 12 weeks. Each pill is $1,100. And they were going to pay 80%. And I'd only owe $18,000 of the $93,000. When I was approved, I got a call from one of the doctor's assistants, and she said, I want you to call this woman at Gilead, which is the company that makes the drug, because they're doing some testing, and they might put you into their tests. And so I called, and she said, yeah, you're a perfect candidate for our test, and what I will do is we'll pay everything except $38. There's $38 we can't pay because it's a part of a fee or something. I can't tell you how fast I wrote that check for $38. $38. So $93,000 worth of drugs for $38. I began taking a pill a day, every day, January, February, and March. At the end of March, I went and had blood work done, and there was no hepatitis. And they wait 3 more months until June, and they do blood work again, and if it's still gone, they consider it a cure. And so that day, I went to the hospital up at Westlake, University Hospital up in Westlake. And I got sent right back to the little room, you know, the little room, and waiting for the doctor. I waited about 15 minutes, and finally he came in. And he's a guy with very little, if no, bedside manner whatsoever. And he leans up against the counter, and he says, "Tony, you're a busy guy. I'm a busy guy. You're cured." Walked out. And so what did I do? I got in the car and I cried all the way to West Akron where my office was. Cried those prayers of thanks. And as I got to Market Street, there's a Walgreens pharmacy that sits there. And there was an elderly black man sitting on the sidewalk, leaning up against the wall of the pharmacy. And there was some nudge that God had given me to go see if he was all right. And so I went over to the man and I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "No, I'm not." I said, "What's the matter?" He says, "I have this prescription. It's a drug that's keeping me alive. I can't get it filled. I don't have the money. I have no family. I have no friends. I have no one that can help me with this prescription." I said, "Do you have it with you?" "Yes, I do." He showed it to me. I helped him to his feet. We went in the Walgreens pharmacy and we got the prescription and I paid for it. It was $38.
Oh, my God.
The exact amount that I paid for $93,000 worth of Harvoni. And from that day, I said, you know, there are people that can't afford drugs. There are people that die because of $38. And because I had a job and insurance and the best doctors and nurses working for me, I was able to do that. This guy had none of that. And so that's when I committed that I was going to try to do some things for people, try to be helpful. You know, you guys took a poll here at Suprema before Christmas. What are some of the things, you know, New Year's resolution? And it's being kind and helping people and learning more about our faith and so forth, passing along those stories. All of those things are what most seniors, myself included, want to do. And so I started working in a couple of instances. One, I've been doing jail ministry for 12 years at Medina County Jail. And it has been a blessing. Jail ministry is difficult. Not everyone can do it. We started out with 40-some people who wanted to do jail ministry the first day. We were down to 12. I remember the first time I went, I went with two elderly women, and as the groups came in, the last group came in, and one of the women said to this big, burly, tattooed guy, she said, "You know, the other people had on the orange costumes, and you guys have on the striped costumes. What does that mean?" And he looked her in the eye and he says, "We kill little old ladies like you." Never seen her again. But it's funny because our ministry is half men, half women. And oftentimes I work with the women and Kathy Anderson, who's my partner, works with the men. We kind of mix it up as we go along. I want to share with you a couple of stories about the jail. And the first one happened many years ago. And part of what we do at night, we do a church service, a little church service. We talk about scripture a little bit. And understand that some of these people have never heard Jesus' name mentioned before, let alone have any kind of relationship. So we're starting with the very basics, you know, and sometimes even starting before the basics. But in addition to that, we get to do some one-on-ones. And this particular night, they had paired me up with a guy, nice-looking kid, about 30 years old, college graduate, and he sat across from me and we talked for maybe 20-30 minutes. And I can't tell you what we talked about. I can't remember. But what I do remember is at the end of the conversation, he said, "I want you to pray for me. I'm going to prison for 25 years. And so I said, "I would. I promised him I would. I do to this day pray for him." And as he got up to go back to the cell, to back to the pod, he gave me a hug and he whispered in my ear, "This must be what it feels like to have a father." And so on the way home that night, another night I cried my way home, and that thought kept going through my mind, "This must be what it feels like to have a father." 80% of the guys in jail have no male figure and no father figure. 60% of all the women in jail, the only male they know are men that have taken abuse them or use them to get drugs and so forth. And so to say that must be what it feels like to have a father just struck me in a very, very touching way. I got home that night, and Diane, who's sitting back there, was reading the paper in the family. I'll show you how long ago it was. We still got the paper. And she said, "Did you read the story in the paper about the guy who raped a six-year-old girl?" And I said, "No, they'll let me have Adam. I'd wring his neck." She said, "Yeah, they sentenced him today to 25 years in prison." And Diane went off to bed, and I sat down and read the article, and it was him. The guy that had hugged me, the guy that asked me to pray for him, the guy that said, "That must be what it feels like to have a father." I was so conflicted. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want any part of jail ministry anymore. And that March, we were in Naples, sunny Naples, sitting at D'Amico's on Route 41, and my phone rang. And Dr. Ray Guarendi, I don't know if that name means anything. Dr. Ray is a psychologist. He lives in Canton, Ohio. He has 10 kids. 7 of them are adopted. 4 of them are special needs. He and his wife have done a great job. He does a radio talk show every single day on EWTN, the Eternal Word Television Network. Dr. Ray called me up, and he was speaking at Ave Maria University, which is right near Naples. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having lunch here at D'Amico's on 41. He says, "I'm coming over." I said, "Okay, I'll buy your lunch." And so he came over and he sat down. And I said, "Dr. Ray, you're a psychologist. Let me tell you a story." And I told him the exact same story I told you. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Tony, what do you call a six-year-old that's raped?" And I said, "A victim." And he says, "What do you call a 30-year-old that does it?" And I go, "A perpetrator, a criminal." And I threw out some words. And he looked at me and he said, "They're the same person." He said, "I will guarantee you, I'll pay for the next lunch. That guy was abused himself as a kid." And I came back and I did some research and I found that that was the case. That he had been sexually abused his entire life. And that that's what he had done. And instead of getting him into a program and getting him some help, what did we do? We sentenced him to 25 years. And he's going to come out at age 55 or 60. And no one has intervened. Not a coach, not a friend, not a father, not a neighbor has intervened in this kid's life. You see, sometimes things aren't as they appear. You know, sometimes we have to give people the benefit of the doubt. There was a girl that we had in jail. They called her Buffy. She was from Rittman. And when I first met Buffy, she looked awful. Hair disheveled, eyes sunken, bloodshot, skin, complexion, just did not look good. And we started talking, and I talked with Buffy over the course of the 9 months that she was in Medina County Jail. And every time I saw Buffy, she looked a little bit better. Combing her hair, complexion comes back, her eyes are clear. She's a pretty girl. And you saw that develop over the course of that time. The last time I saw her, she told me, "Tony, I'm going to be getting out, and I have nowhere to go." At the time, there were 6 beds for women, rehab beds for women, 6 in Medina County. There's 62 animal shelters in Medina County, 62. But there were 6 beds for women, now there are 11. And hopefully with the hospital situation, we're going to have a lot of that remedied, you know, thank God. And so I said, "You need to talk to the chaplain, Sue Jarvis, a wonderful woman. She and her husband Larry are the chaplains there. You need to see what we can do. Maybe another county can take it, whatever." And that's the last time I saw Buffy. And then a couple of weeks later, we were having a jail ministry meeting at the Panera, and we're sitting there, and one of the women I work with, Connie Ebaugh from out in the county, Our Lady Help of Christians is her parish, and she said, "Tony, did you hear about Buffy?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, they released her Thursday, and she died of an overdose on Sunday." I said, all the time that I had spent, did I fail Buffy? Did the system fail Buffy? Did the courts fail Buffy? Did her friends and family fail Buffy? Who failed Buffy? You know, that awful feeling in the pit of your stomach. And you see, those are the stories that help you to learn that there are people that are hurting. The opioid epidemic that we've heard about, some of you have probably been to meetings on, the opioid epidemic is real. 78% of the people I see every Tuesday night in jail are heroin addicts, and they don't look like what you picture in your mind as a heroin addict. They look like your kids and my kids. They're normal looking kids from Wadsworth and from Medina and from Seville and Sterling and Ritten. And they're in there with opioid addictions. They're mothers, housewives, in there with opioid addictions. And, you know, our job is not to judge them. Our job is to love them. We're not going to judge them back to health. We're going to love them back to health. It is our job not to be judgmental, but to try to be helpful. And we have so many people who are quick to judge. Oh, just lock them up. Put them away. That's not what we need to do. There were two girls a month ago sitting in the room. One girl had been living in a tent when her mom and her four-year-old daughter were begging for her to come indoors. She lived in a tent for one reason. She could shoot heroin until she got arrested. The other girl had been sleeping in the doorways of the stores, you know, to where you can get a little bit out of the wind, until she was arrested. Both of them said it was the best thing that ever happened to them, to get arrested, to get them off the street, to try to get them some help. We should be in awe of what they're going through instead of judging the way they're going through it. When I meet someone in the jail, I'm in awe of the crap they've had to go through. I can't judge them. I can only love them, right? Mother Teresa says, the reason there's no peace in the world is because we forget that we belong to each other, that our job is to belong to each other. And so that's some stories about the jail. The other thing I do is I like to work with the homeless. You know, the homeless man leaning up against the drugstore got me involved with Springtime of Hope and with the Haven of Rest and with the Catholic Worker and Salvation Army and so on. And so I've got a couple of stories to tell. One is the homeless Bible study. Now, back several years ago, St. Bernard's Church, which is right in downtown, they would feed on Friday night any homeless people that would come. And we would get in anywhere from 200 to 400 homeless people would come and have dinner. And then after that, we would give them what they needed, shelter, toilet paper, different things. Boots, socks, coats. And one of my friends said to me, you know, Tony, you ought to do a Bible study. Who's going to come to a Bible study? And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. The next week, I said, they put up a sign, after you're done eating and get your stuff, if you want, there's a Bible study. Two guys showed up with Bibles. And their Bibles were well thumbed through because they've been using them. And we had a Bible study. And this was right at the fall, at the beginning. And as we came into the Advent season, as we got closer and closer to Christmas and the weather got worse and worse, one night there was about a foot of snow on the ground and we had a little fire and we sat in chairs around the fire just trying to stay warm. And there were 24 people at the Bible study. And I was... My Bible study that night was on the 2 Corinthians, where it says that God is faithful and he will see you through and he will give you a way out. And as I began to read that piece of scripture, they all recited it from memory. It's a scripture that homeless people know. And the end of the Bible study, a large man, big black guy named Mo, got up. 45 years in prison, Mo spent. Hands chapped and scratched and bloody. Teeth missing. And he said, I'd like to sing. Everybody looked at Big Mo. Who's going to say no to Big Mo? And Big Mo sang the impossible dream. Dream the impossible dream. A modern day homeless Don Quixote. And it came from that homeless Bible study. One day I was getting up to go to Mass here at Sacred Heart. I try to go every morning when I can, several mornings a week. And I woke up that morning and there was some nudge that I got that said, don't go. Go to St. Bernard's at 1210. So whenever that happens, do you ever get nudges? Yeah, I'll tell you where they come. Somebody, you'll get a nudge to call somebody. And you call them, and what's the first thing they say when you call them? I was just thinking about you. Boy, this is great. Huh? It's a nudge. We call them God bumps, God nudges, God winks. There's all kind of names for them. I call them God appointments. If God wanted me to be at St. Bernard's at 1210, then that's where I was going, and I went. Now, St. Bernard's a big church, probably 1,200 seats. And as I walked in the side door where I always walk in, there was a girl sitting in my seat. 1,200 seats. She's in my seat. So I walk over and I get in the same row. I'm like two down from where my seat is. And Mass began, and I open the hymnal, and I notice she's kind of lost. And so I open the hymnal, and I walk kind of down closer to her, and I hand her the hymnal, and I point to the hymn. And she kind of brings it over so we can both read from it, and we do. And I could tell during the course of the church service that this wasn't something she'd ever done before. You could just tell. And so Mass ends, and I kind of say goodbye to her. And she stops me and says, can I share something with you? And I said, sure. She said, I have an appointment at the courthouse. And I owe a fine of $50. And I didn't have the money. All I had was a bus pass. And so I took the bus here. And I walked from the bus station to the courthouse and spotted this church. And for the first time in my life, I walked into a church. And I said, I'm going to go in there and pray for a miracle. And she said, you see that elderly woman sitting down there? I said, yes. She said, she saw me crying and asked me what was wrong. I told her I needed $50 to pay the court for a fine and I didn't have the money. And the little old lady reached in her purse and pulled out her checkbook and wrote a check for $50 to the court. And she held up the check and the little woman's name started with Judge. And then I said, that's fantastic. Isn't that a great miracle story? And then I turned to leave, she stopped me again. This time she said, I haven't eaten in 3 days. Is there any way you can help me? And this was one of the days I had absolutely no money on me. Diane gives me $20 a month allowance. I had burned through it already. And I said, I don't have any money, but right over the hill, Akron U has a little cafeteria, and I think there's an ATM machine. Come with me. And we walked down the hill together, and there was an ATM machine, and it happened to be my bank. And so I got her enough money for the day and to maybe eat a few times. And it was getting close to the time she needed to be at the court. So I handed her the money, and I walked her back up the hill. And as she went to cross the street over to the courthouse, she turned and gave me the biggest hug. And she said, I went to a church for the first time in my life expecting a miracle, and I got two. And I've been to St. Bernard many times since then, and she's always there. Only she's never in my seat. Because the last thing I said to her before she went to court was, and by the way, you were in my seat. Another organization I like to work with is the Community Pregnancy Center in Barberton. I don't know if any of you are aware of it, but they provide infant formula and diapers and car seats and layettes and formula and all of those things for infants and women who can't afford them. Right now, since the last fall, free ultrasound. A woman can go there with no money and get a free ultrasound. Isn't that fantastic? Mm-hmm. Community Pregnancy Center is in a beautiful 5,000 square foot facility, all completely decorated. My lovely wife helped with the decorating on First Street in Barberton. It used to be in a tiny little house out on Worcester Avenue. And I read, this is 26 years ago, I read in the church bulletin that they were out of formula and they needed formula. And I had gotten a check from a speech I had given, and I said to Diane, I'm going to go buy formula and bring it to the pregnancy center. She said, that's a great idea. So I went to Kroger's. I don't know if you remember Kroger's over there. And I had enough money to get 5 cases of formula. Now, formula then was liquid. It wasn't powdered. It came in a big can. Very expensive stuff, I found out. And I had enough for 5 cases. So I said to the guy, I'd like to get 5 cases of Similac, because I knew Similac with iron is what my kids had, you know, years ago, 35 and 39 years ago. And he had 4 cases of Similac. And I said, could you go in the back and check? And he went, no, we don't have any other Similac, but I have a case of Infamil. I didn't know what that was, so I took that. And so I drove over to Barberton, and I went to the back door of the little house, and I knocked on the door, and a volunteer, elderly woman, came to the door, and she says, can I help you, honey? And I go, I got some formula. Bring it in, put it on the kitchen table. And so I brought in 2 cases of Similac, and I put it on the kitchen table. And as I walked by, the dining room was the director, Pat Shea's office. And she was in there with a young girl. And she looked at me and kind of smiled. I did not know her from Adam. So I went back out, and I got the other 2 cases of Similac, and I brought it in, and I set it down, and she smiled again. And then I went out and got the case of Infamil, and I brought it in. As I got close to the door, she looked at me and got up from her desk. And she walked out and said, is that Infamil? And I said, yes, it is. And she said, the girl in my office's baby can only have Infamil, and we're totally out of Infamil. Would you bring it to her car? And I did. I carried the case of Infamil to her car. And as I'm carrying it, I could hear Pat Shea. This is when I still had hearing. I could hear Pat Shea say to the young girl, problem solved, an angel just dropped off some Infamil. Now, some of you know me, I've been called a lot of things. Angel is not one of them. And it really made an impact on me. And so I began bringing formula. And later I got involved. Diane sat on their board for 10 years. And I do all of their strategic planning. And our strategic planning started with a budget of $40,000 in a little house. And we just raised last Saturday night $160,000 a day. And we've got a beautiful facility and free ultrasound and free pregnancy tests and all that stuff going on at the Community Pregnancy Center. And you know why? There are a lot more angels out there than me. Got lots of angels. And so that's another organization I work with. And I just wanted to pass some of these stories along because it allows you to read yourself into them and things that have happened to you along the way. One of my favorite aunts, Aunt Jay, Antoinette was her name, but we called her Aunt Jay. She worked at the city laundry for 90 cents an hour. And she saved up her money, and every year she would buy me and my sister and 3 of my cousins, Diane, Stephen, and Susan, winter coats. Now, at 90 cents an hour, you got to work pretty hard to buy 5 winter coats. But every year, she bought 5 winter coats. And that was impressive to me. And as I became an adult, I remembered that. And one particular year, the pregnancy center was doing a Christmas thing, and they needed winter coats. And Diane had read in the paper that the Rolling Acres outlet, or the Penny's outlet at Rolling Acres, had coats for like, I don't know, 10 bucks or something. So we packed up and got in the car, and I grabbed a couple of carts, and I start loading coats into these carts, figuring I'm going to pay back my Aunt Jay. And as I loaded the carts, I kind of maneuvered the 2 carts to the checkout, and the checkouts were backed up halfway out the store. But just as I did, a young girl opened a new checkout, and she kind of nodded to me, and I kind of wheeled my 2 carts over, and Diane was right there with me, and we got in the line. And the girl at the checkout, you could tell she had been crying, and she was pregnant. And she said, what are all these coats for? And I said, oh, they're for the pregnancy center. What's that? Diane explained to her what the pregnancy center was. And she says, my boyfriend left me. My parents kicked me out of the house. I'm living in one room in Barberton. I have nothing. And Diane jotted down the phone number of the pregnancy center and said, call, which she did. And she got help for her baby, and she got help for herself, and a coat for her own self as well. And so the paying it forward allowed her to get the help. You see what God appointments are? These things happen. They're not coincidence. I don't believe in coincidence. You know, Albert Einstein was a devout Jew. Most people don't know that. And Einstein said, there's two ways to view life. As if everything is a miracle, or as if nothing is a miracle. And you know how I view life? As if everything is a miracle. And so, passing along our stories to our next generation is really, really important. That they get to know what grandma and grandpa did, what motivated us, what kept us moving forward, how we reacted to the cancer diagnosis or the Parkinson's disease. All of those things that happen as we get older. How did grandma and grandpa do it? How did they get through it? Isn't that great potential? And so when people, when Lori told me that people really want to get not only closer to the Lord, but they want to reach out. And I tell them this little prayer. Now, I usually begin with this little prayer, but I thought I'd end with it today. And it's a prayer I pray every morning. Been doing it for years. And usually when I receive the Eucharist at Mass, I say, Lord, make me an instrument. Put somebody in my life today that you can help through me. I'm just checking in for duty. Lord, make me an instrument. Put somebody in my life today that you can help, God, through me. Let me be your hands. Let me be your eyes and sight and do that. I tell people, don't pray that prayer unless you mean it. Do not pray that prayer unless you mean it, because it works 100% of the time. It's one of the 10 prayers God always says yes to. Lord, make me an instrument. Put somebody in my life today that you can help through me. Happens every day. Every day you get a nudge. And it doesn't just happen to me. It happens to all of you. What you have to be doing is get the antenna out there and react to the nudges. If you get a nudge to call someone, you know what you should do? Call them. There's a girl I work with, 3-time cancer survivor named Rena. She does a thing called the 3 o'clock call. Every day at 3 o'clock, she stops what she's doing and calls someone. I said, do you ever run out of people to call? She says, never. I've been doing it for 20 years. Never run out of people to call. There's always somebody sick, hurting, in the hospital, just got out of the hospital, had a problem, you know, got divorced. There's always somebody to call. And so she does the 3 o'clock call. I tried it for a while, and it's really cool. I try to do it from time to time. I haven't been as every day at 3 o'clock. But, you know, little bumps, little things happen. One day I was at Mass and I said, Lord, make me an instrument. Put somebody in my life today that you can help through me. And I've had a rough morning, so you may have to hit me in the head, but if you have to hit me in the head, hit me in the head. And so that day I had a little check. I had to pay a bill and I had a little check at the bank, and I was going to use the little check to pay the bill and get the change and get out of it. So I would go into a bank that isn't my branch. It was the same bank, but a different branch. Never been there before. And I walk up, and I overheard a young woman in the next line talking to the teller, and she was trying to pay her mortgage with cash, and she was $3.80-some cents short. And I overheard that. So I pay my bill, the teller gives me some change, and I go back out to my car, and I open the door, and I get in my car, and the sun visor comes down and hits me right in the head. Ow! And I looked at my hand and I had some change. And I walked back in the bank. I said, how much do you need? $3.87. I said, guess what I have? How much was it? $3.87. I gave it to her and she hugged me, and the teller came around and hugged me. Everybody hugged me. What was I going to do with $3.87? To me, that's, you know, 2 Snicker bars and a Diet Coke. So I am. You see how those little things happen?